Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jonathan Safran Foer, whose latest novel is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. First novel is Everything is Illuminated. Before we get into Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, let's talk a little about Everything is Illuminated. The book is about a person named Jonathan Safran Foer's search for his ancestors and what happened to the woman who saved his grandfather's life in the Ukraine. And it's based on your own trip to the Ukraine, is that correct?
True. Summer after my sophomore year of college, I went to the Ukraine making a trip very, very much like the character, my namesake, in the first book did. I had a photograph of a woman who I'd been told saved my grandfather from the Nazis, and I went looking for her. Once I got there, the reality of my trip was nothing at all like what happened in the book. I didn't meet anybody like Alex, the verbally challenged guide, or Alex's grandfather, or the dog, or the people they meet. Nothing was like that. I just found this total and complete absence, just really nothing but nothing. And I guess that's what allowed for the book, or demanded the book.
The character of Alex is a very unique voice. How did you come by that voice? How did you create that strange, awkward voice that works so well?
I don't really know, to be honest. When I write, often what happens is I play around with lots of different things, lots of different ideas, lots of different voices, and if something attracts my attention, I just pursue it. I stick with it. And that usually lasts for an hour, maybe 4 hours, sometimes a day, sometimes a week, sometimes a month. And if something can last over time, then you've really got something. And, you know, a book takes 3 years, 4 years. So when I was writing Alex, something about him really attracted me. I felt very, very sympathetically toward him, and he made me laugh really hard. In part, he drove me to pursue him, and then in pursuing him, I shaped him. You know, the more I wrote of him, the better I got to understand the kinds of things he would say and wouldn't say.
And then you went back. It sounds like, from what you've talked about your new book, that you do a lot of rewriting.
It's all rewriting in a way. You know, every day I start at the beginning of the book, every single day, and read through what I have. So the days get longer, you know, as the book gets longer. But I don't even know the difference between writing something for the first time and editing it. I feel like I'm always editing.
The other two sections of that book consist of kind of the history of a shtetl in the Ukraine, as well as the other story, kind of written by Alex, which involves the story of this character, Jonathan Safran Foer, in the Ukraine. Did they all come together at once, or did you kind of realize in working on one section that the other sections were going to emerge?
It was kind of neither of the two. It happened very organically. It was not all at once. It was definitely not written as the book ended, you know, as it was published. It was a lot of finding my way and figuring out balances, knowing that I wanted to convey some information like this and some like that, knowing I wanted to approach the story from the past, knowing that I wanted to, you know, move forward in time, but also have a part that was moving backward in time. I think as a reader, one of the things I really value, it's like an argumentative book. You know, Philip Roth is one of my favorite writers, and I think one reason is his books are always presented as arguments. They're always opposing voices, and I wanted my book to be that kind of book.
When you were working on the construction, this was when you were in college, right? This was originally a senior thesis or some kind of thesis?
I actually worked on it before my thesis. I mean, I wrote a lot of it in that summer of my trip. So it was summer after my sophomore year. I ended up spending about 10 weeks in Prague after I went to the Ukraine. And I wrote a kind of draft of the book while I was there. And I kept working on it. I did work on it as part of my thesis, and I worked on it after that as well once I graduated.
And then you put it aside and put it in a drawer until Dale Peck asked you about it. How did that story come about?
Basically, when I graduated, I didn't know what I was going to do with my book. I didn't even know it was a book exactly. I knew I was working on something very hard, and I knew that I had completed a story, but it takes a big imaginative leap if you're a non-writer to think of yourself as somebody who's written a book. Yeah, I met Dale through the Joseph Cornell book that I edited, and he said, you know, what is it that you do? I said, well, I fiddle around, I do this, I do that, I write a little. What have you written? Well, I sort of have this draft of a book. Where is this book? It's in my desk drawer. Well, can I see it? And I showed it to him. And he said, you should take this out of your desk drawer, try to do something with it.
At which point did you just keep reworking it or what?
At that point, I sent it to an agent who rejected it. Then I sent it to six more agents, all of whom rejected it. Then I sent it to another agent who accepted it. She sent it to, I think, five or six publishers, all of whom rejected it. She fell ill, had to go back to Denmark, where she was from, and where she could get good health care. I sent it to two more agents, both of whom rejected it. And then finally, I sent it to the agent I currently have, and my life changed very dramatically and very quickly.
What were the kinds of letters you got from just keep trying, or somebody will buy it, or just good luck?
My experience has been every rejection letter is some form of this. Clearly, this is a work of genius. There's just no room for it on our list. What you've written is really tremendous, but I'm not that interested.
The book comes out, and suddenly you're lionized out of the blue. How hard was it, is it still hard, to reconcile that strange public Jonathan Safran IV with the person?
It's not very public. The writing world is very small and insulated and self-referential, so things that seem big within it really aren't big in the general scheme of things. Like, I'm a person who lives in a neighborhood in a city. The vast majority of my friends are not writers and don't have anything to do with literature other than being, you know, readers. To them, I'm somebody who has a job, and my job is I'm a writer. When I go down the street, I'm somebody who walks down the street. I'm not a writer who walks down the street. And it's great. It's something I value because I'm not a writer. I'm a person, and a large part of what I do is write. And it's one of the most important things that I do in my life. It's only a part of what I do. And I've been, I guess, lucky in being able to keep it as, you know, a really segmented part of my life.
What kind of research did you do into shtetl life? Are you familiar with Singer's work?
I am. I actually became more familiar with it after I wrote my book, though. I didn't do a lot of research. It didn't require a lot of research, the kind of book that I wrote. You know, it's really imaginative, and I wanted it to be imaginative. It's a kind of writing. I don't think I value it any more than I might value, like, social realism, but it's what I do. It's what I'm drawn toward, and it's usually what I'm drawn toward as a reader also.
People make comments about your style being postmodern, and I know that, you know, when I tried to get John Barth to define it, and, you know, he said, well, it comes after modern. How do you view it? I mean, do you think in those terms at all, or is it just kind of too organic for you?
I think they're nonsense. I mean, I think they're really silly, all of that terminology. And again, speaking of the literary world being self-referential, like, the literary world is what's postmodern. It's what's constantly trying to define itself and talk about itself. And it's really damaging, actually. You know, I was thinking the other day, literature is probably the only art form that would still use the word gimmick. What would be a gimmicky in a painting? What would be gimmicky in a song?
So when you read those reviews that call your second book gimmicky, how does it make you feel?
I think they're wrong. I mean, I'm sure they're wrong. I mean, I'm also sure that books aren't for everybody. No book is for everybody, and you don't need to please everybody. You don't want to please everybody. A book that pleased everybody couldn't be a good book. But I think that the literary world is increasingly conservative, more and more and more protective of how things were done in the past, more and more protective of the boundaries of the novel, and less open to new ways of describing things, new ways of saying things.
Jonathan Safran IV, let's talk a little bit about Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. The book concerns 9/11 and a 9-year-old kid whose father dies in the Twin Towers. Jonathan Safran IV, you said that you wanted to tell the tale because it's always been told with messages. And Time magazine said you're trying to depoliticize it and strip it of ideology. Is that an accurate assessment?
It is, but it's not why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because, for the same reason I wrote my first book, same reason I go to books in the first place. It's not because of specific ways of handling specific situations, but the kinds of, I guess, themes that are written about. You know, I was really interested in writing about loss. It's interesting in writing about how the imagination can try to reclaim things and sometimes actually reclaim things, the role of, you know, invention in life. The specific setting was New York and the contemporary moment, and because of that, September 11th was going to play some sort of role. I chose for it to be a pretty explicit role. There was only one kind of storytelling about September 11th, really, and it was biographical, or I guess political also. You know, the journalists and politicians really controlled the ways that we were talking about it. Those are two important kinds of voices, two important kinds of stories, but they're not the only kinds. And one kind that was missing was an individualistic story, the story of specific people in specific moments coping in specific ways, particularly looking at those stories through an emotional lens or an empathetic lens, just didn't really exist. In part, it didn't exist because it takes a long time to write books. It takes a long time to make art. It doesn't take a long time to make journalism. You know, Tom Brokaw was down at Ground Zero within, what, an hour? And there's a price you pay for that. The news coverage in the beginning was awful. It was alarmist and overblown and just factually incorrect. But that's okay, because that's the price you pay for trying to respond to these things as quickly as you can, which I think is a very good instinct.
Where were you at the time?
I was in New York. I was in my apartment in Jackson Heights. You know, like so many people in New York and so many people around the world, I watched everything unfold on TV, and I spent 3 days just watching TV.
The part that got me, that hit me, was the grandmother talking about the towers. She was just watching it, thinking about it. It seemed to me that that was maybe the purest example of what I was feeling in California.
Right, and she says, you know, at first it was this abstract thing, like, is it a movie? What am I looking at? There's that. There's the disorientation. And then there's that really awful curiosity that kicked in. She said she wanted to know how it was going to end. And she hated herself for wanting to know, but she wanted to know. And then she talks about just the repetition of images, like the planes going into the buildings, bodies falling. And that was the story of the day, and that's, I think, the story of the memory of the day, are these images. September 11th was the most visually documented event in human history. Nothing has ever been seen by so many people. And that's in part because it had such an incredibly strong visual presence. You know, those buildings are so iconic, and the planes going into them are so dramatic. You know, the world had never been so visual. People had never had such access to televisions, to the internet, to newspapers. And so I wanted the book to have a kind of visual language to reflect that.
Was that one of the reasons for the photos and the use of visual use of type?
I really wanted the form of the book to echo the content. So there are two ways in which I tried to do that. One is the things I was just saying about September 11th. The other is this character of Oscar, this 9-year-old with an incredibly flamboyant imagination who's perpetually inventing. We at first think these are kind of whimsical inventions. Then I hope it's clear that this is just these attempts to fill in all of the absences in his life, you know, or to keep his brain busy so it doesn't start thinking about things he doesn't want to think about. I wanted the book to be an invention. You know, I wanted the book to feel like his imagination.
Were you worried about whether the character himself came across as a real 9-year-old?
It's interesting you ask that. I didn't care. My goal was never to create a realistic 9-year-old for a couple of reasons. One, I think the book moves into a kind of mythical territory as it goes forward. You know, there's something about his journey through New York is supposed to feel archetypal. It's a quest, yeah. Also, novels aren't supposed to be realistic. That's not their function. Their function is they're supposed to feel real. They're supposed to evoke responses. I knew the kinds of responses I wanted to evoke. One was laughter at certain times. One was a kind of empathy. One was the feeling of wanting to be along with this kid on his journey and wanting him to get what he needs to get and knowing he won't get it. So in an effort to evoke those things, sometimes you have to tell certain lies in terms of, you know, the object that you're referring to in order to get the truths about the evocations. Everything in a book is fake. You know, there's no Oscar in the world. There's no grandfather. These are all fictions. And it's useful to remember that. But the evocations are very, very real. Like the ways that they, like hearing somebody laugh aloud when they read something, a laugh is a real thing. So it's kind of like throwing a non-existent stone into a lake to get these very real ripples. And so when I was creating the stone that is Oscar, I wasn't thinking, what's the mineral composition of this? How heavy is it? What's its size? I was thinking, when it hits the lake, what will the ripples look like? And how can I shape this in order to have the ripples be what I want them to be?
Given your newfound success at the time and given the directions you were going, was it easy to keep the fear down that this novel might not be dealt with in the way that you would have liked?
When my first book was having some success, I cannot tell you how many people said to me, you're going to have an unpleasant experience. Like a lot of people are going to go after your book. Published my second book. Lo and behold, they were right. Like a lot of people went after it. That having been said, I feel like this experience has been much more positive than my first book. Maybe because I value more writing, I realize how hard it is more. And I'm, you know, for that reason, more proud of myself just to have finished a book. Like, it was really, really difficult. And getting to meet readers, it's like a magical thing. It's much more magical now that I know what goes into writing and what goes into reading, what goes into the process of publishing a book. You know, connecting the intimate experience of writing something with the intimate experience of reading something. You know, when I was writing, I had some anxieties. The anxiety of what some reviewer would say was not one of them. Or if it was, it was very, very low on the list of things. High at the list of things was, this is my second book. I will only have one second book in my life. So I would like to do something that feels meaningful.
Jonathan Safran Foer, you say in the little bio of Everything is Illuminated, you talk about your next book being a museum novel, and I read that this is the museum novel, though there's no museum in it. How do you get from that point A to the point B?
One step at a time. You know this old philosophical problem of if you leave a harbor in a boat and in the course of your journey as you're crossing the sea, you replace every single plank in the boat. When you get to your destination, would you say that you are arriving in the same boat that you departed? And it's tricky. I don't know. Honestly, I can't pinpoint moments where I said I had this and now I have that.
Well, where did Oscar come in?
Oscar came in part because, you know, when I was saying that, you know, I was talking about the creation of Alex and this desire to pursue things that interest you or move you. I don't remember why I started writing Oscar, but I did. I had a couple pages of him.
Inside the museum.
It might have even been outside. I just don't remember. All I know is one day I was sitting around working on him and I started to like him. And then he found his way into the museum as another voice. And then he was eating up everything. I mean, he was just taking up space in the way that he does in this book. You know, he wants to be loud and he wants to be everywhere. And so certain things started falling by the wayside. You know, the one real constant from the beginning was that it took place in New York in the contemporary moment. I think that was what guided the book more than any character, more than any plot.
The other sections, the section in Dresden, that came in later then, after Oscar?
It did. It came in after Oscar, but it resonated with things that were happening to this diarist in the original version of the book. And nothing exactly disappears, and nothing appears out of nowhere. I feel like when I write, I have this set of concerns which keep surfacing and resurfacing and expressed in different ways, but I recognize that it's always the same concerns, and sometimes it's explicit. You know, sometimes a specific scene will be replayed in a slightly different way or it's set in a different context, but sometimes it's not at all explicit. It's very subtle, just like how difficult it is to communicate, to say what you mean to say at a given moment. That's a concern that I've noticed keeps resurfacing. I think the book is formed around those.
You're listening to an interview with Jonathan Safran Foer, whose latest novel is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. First novel, Everything is Illuminated. Both books, interestingly enough, they deal with children and grandparents and not with parents. There's very little parental material in there. Your grandparents played a huge influence on your life. How conscious was it, the idea of focusing on grandparents and not at all on parent-child relations?
It wasn't conscious. No, you know, the Auden quote, I look at what I write so that I can see what I think. That's how it is with me. I didn't start out saying, let's explore the relationship of grandparents to parents and let's remove the middle generation, have it be a kind of present absence and X, Y, and Z. No, it's that I wrote, and I wrote out of my instincts. I wrote out of what I was thinking about and feeling at the time. And after I had, like, accumulated a fair number of pages, I looked back and I said, I must be interested in grandparents, or I must be interested in not talking about parents, because both of my books, you're right, do it.
There's a little flip book at the end of Incredibly Close. Where did that surface?
So the flip book is a series of images of a body rising through the sky. And in the context of the book, Oscar is imagining September 11th, the day, moving in reverse, everything happening backward, and at the end, everyone being safe. And, you know, it's the thing that he can't have that he wants. Where did it come from? I don't know, but I always knew that that was the right way to end the book, because it brings to the surface, it makes most explicit the conflict in the book, which is between imagination and reality. When Oscar is inventing, is he moving toward truth or is he moving away from truth? Are there different senses of truth? Obviously, there's biographical truth. Maybe there is something to an imaginative truth. Like I was saying before with novels, you know, nothing in them is real, yet they do have these real effects on life. Stephen Hawking, to whom Oscar writes lots and lots of letters through.
Now, that letter that Hawking wrote to Oscar is not a real letter.
Well, only Stephen Hawking and I know for sure. But in that final letter, Stephen Hawking says, you know, Oscar, you said in one of your letters, what if I never stop inventing? And Stephen Hawking says, maybe you're not inventing. Maybe what you're doing, maybe you're making real things. He uses the analogy of dark matter in the universe, that the universe depends on things we will never be able to see, hear, taste, or touch, never be able to experience with our senses. But we know it's there. And again, the universe depends on it. And, you know, there are things in our lives that are not real, but that life depends on. And maybe the imagination can do that, can create things that enable life.
The question is if it's an unfolding of what we already know or something new, and maybe they're the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Jonathan Safran Foer, how do you know a book is done?
You know, a book is probably never exactly done. I think it's when the rate of change just gets so painfully small that it's time to move on. You know, I could read this book for the rest of my life, and every time I moved through it, I would change at least one thing. Possibly on every single page, but certainly in the book, I would change something. In the beginning, you're changing things quite dramatically, and then you're moving more or less onto the sentence level, and then the word level, and then at a certain point, like, do I want to be somebody who's fine-tuning something for the rest of my life? You know, there's the concern that you're not even expressing yourself anymore. Like, you're expressing some previous version of yourself. Like, my concerns are different now. When I look back at my book, of course there are things I want to change. Of course there are things that I'm even embarrassed by already, but that doesn't mean anything. I wouldn't change them, given the choice, because, you know, writing books, it's not like the high jump where you're constantly trying to clear a greater height. I'm not trying to write better and better books. That's not the point. The point is I'm trying to write books that are more fitting for who I am. in a given moment. And as I change, my sense of writing changes, the book should change.
What do you think of someone like John Fowles who's willing to take the Magus and 20 years later rewrite it?
I've only been a writer for about 5 years, 6 years, so it's really, I mean, and because of that, I really can't answer that. I so much respect people who have done this for a long time, in part because as I was saying before, I realize it gets harder as you go. I saw W.G. Zabel give one of his last readings. Maybe it was his last reading in the States in Queens College. And he said, being a writer is not like being a doctor. You know, the 10th appendix of your move is easier than the first. By the 100th, you can more or less do it blindfolded. Being a writer gets harder and harder and harder because you better realize all of the possibilities and all of the things that you're choosing against. You know, there's so many different stories in the world that really deserve to be told and should be told and would be fun to tell, really fun to spend time thinking about. But you have to make choices. You have to rule out an infinite minus one number of things. And that one thing is what you stand up with and you say, this is who I am. In 20 years, you know, I'm willing to respect any decision somebody makes who's been writing for 20 years.
It sounds like one thing that you do, Jonathan Safran Foer, a lot of people start writing and they hit dead ends. It sounds to me like you would just take that piece and tweak it until it was no longer a dead end.
Dead ends hasn't really been a problem for me. Maybe it will be. But my problem is not finding things to write, not writing, but writing things that feel meaningful enough, that feel necessary. I don't want to write something that's just entertaining. Literature has no burden to entertain. There really is enough entertaining film or entertaining TV or entertaining whatever else. Literature can do plenty of things, though, that other art forms can't do. I think that's what you want to pursue as a writer, you know, the things that only a book can do, and hopefully the things that only you can do in the form of a book.
Does a book always have to tell a story?
Not necessarily, no. I don't think so. I think it's probably hard to keep somebody's attention if you're not telling some sort of story. And if a book doesn't keep your attention, it can't do anything.
So the number one priority, no matter what you're doing, is to try to maintain the reader's attention then. I mean, on some level.
No, it's not the number one priority. It's like saying, is your life priority for your heart to beat? No. But if my heart isn't beating, I can't do anything. My life's priority is to, well, I don't know what, to feel like I am moving forward, to feel like I'm changing, to feel like I'm doing things that are important, to be honest to people I care about. Of course, I can't do any of those things if my heart isn't beating, but I would never describe the beating of my heart as a priority. In the same way, a book has to be entertaining, but it's not a priority.
Jonathan Safran Foer, what books have you read that just spark you that way?
Oh, Kafka really sparks me that way. Ovid's Metamorphoses sparks me that way. Calvino, Marquez, Salman Rushdie. Actually, a lot of poetry recently has been getting the old juices flowing.
And when you're talking Rushdie and Garcia Marquez, you're talking magic realism, kind of moving away from the realistic, but that doesn't seem to be your goal anyway.
I have enough reality in my daily life. You know, one of the things I like about writing is how it can be the exception. Not how it can portray what happens, but how it can be the exception to what happens. You know, writing isn't bound by time. And because of that, you can get all sorts of things right that you can't get right when you are bound by time in your sort of daily walking around reality. You know, like how many conversations do you leave and think, I wish I had said this, or I wish I hadn't said that? And in fiction, there's never an excuse to end a book and say, I wish I had said this, or I wish I hadn't said that.
Jonathan Safran Foer, you're working on several other projects, which I'd like to ask you about here. One is a movie of Everything is Illuminated. Did you have anything to do with the movie?
No, I'm not working on it. They are making a movie. It's going to come out in August. Have high hopes, but it's just not my project.
What is the Future Dictionary of America?
Future Dictionary of America came out a couple months before the election, and it was a book that I edited with Dave Eggers and Nicole Krauss, my wife. And it was an anthology, about 80, 90 writers contributed words, new words or new definitions of old words for this imagined future dictionary, and 100% of the proceeds went to Move On.
And Joe?
Joe's a book that I am doing with the sculptor Richard Serra and the photographer Hiroshi Sugimoto. To make a short story short, Serra was commissioned to make a sculpture in the memory of Joe Pulitzer in St. Louis, and he did. Hiroshi Sugimoto took all of these incredibly gorgeous photographs of this sculpture, very abstract, black and white, out of focus, hard to even know what you're looking at. And I wrote some short stories to accompany these photographs, and it's going to be a big art book.
Jonathan Safran Foer, you're also working on a libretto for an opera. What's that about?
About a year ago, I got a phone call, and somebody said, hello, this is Jörn Weisbord. I said, excuse me, I can't hear you. You have a very bad connection and also a heavy accent. It was a German guy. He said, you know, I work for the Deutsche Staatsoper, and would you like to write a libretto? And so I spent, you know, the better part of a year working on it. It's going to premiere in September in Berlin.
How do you feel about working in that medium?
I won't know until I see it. Yeah, it's interesting. Unlike writing, it really does depend entirely on others. You know, when I write a book, I know what book is going to be published. When I wrote this libretto, it can be interpreted so liberally. I don't know what I'm going to see, but I'm pretty sure I'll be surprised.
Are you very familiar with opera as a whole?
Oh, no. No. No, I don't even really like opera. I don't even like opera. I don't know. Is Queen opera? Does that count?
Given all of the publicity and given the tours and given all of this project, how can you focus yourself on working on your third novel?
Because I love to write. That's what I want to do. That's what I set out to do. I didn't set out to give interviews, you know. I like what they do, which is they connect, you know, the intimate experience of writing with the intimate experience of reading. Like, and I love the idea of, like, books connecting people, of books that engage people. I want to write books that engage people. I'm lucky because the vast majority of my time, you know, in every 3 years, if I'm lucky, every 4 years, one book published. And then I spend a month, you know, touring around, and it's really fun. It's, like, great to meet readers. It's great to have conversations like this and talk about the things that I've been thinking about. It doesn't make anything harder. It makes things easier. It makes me appreciate the whole process, and it makes me anxious to get back to the writing. And it's inspiring.
Jonathan Safran Foer, two questions. The first, there was an explosion at Murch Elementary School in 1985. On what level, or maybe on every level, has that affected, you know, your entire artistic career?
So when I was 9 years old, actually the age of the protagonist in this new book, I was part of this summer program. And there, as you were saying, there was an accident. It was a chemistry class, and several kids were almost killed, very severely disfigured. And I was lucky for absolutely no good reason at all. I happened to be standing by the door when it happened. How has it influenced what I've done? I think I'm just figuring that out now. You know, looking back, I've written two books. The titles are Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Both are perfect descriptions of the explosion, of my relationship to the explosion. I didn't intend it in either case. I didn't intend for this 9-year-old who has suffered the loss of a father in my second book and become an artist in response to it. I didn't intend that as some sort of, oh, I don't know, metaphor for my own experience. But I was a 9-year-old and I suffered a great loss, and I probably became an artist because of it. I think it returns to that Auden idea of you look at what you write so that you can see what you think. I'm so grateful for my writing, if only because I can look back and say, these things have been important to me.
And finally, you're working on a third novel now?
Novel schmovel. I think it's going to be, you know, my sister-in-law just had a kid, her first kid, and she's taken a couple months off of work to spend time with her daughter, to really experience motherhood, to physically recuperate. I would love to have that same luxury afforded me. You know, nobody would ask her if she's getting pregnant again. And the idea of writing another novel is as absurd to me as the idea of her getting pregnant right away.
You've been listening to an interview with Jonathan Safran Foer, whose two novels are Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.